entire purpose of this game, to capture and keep attention until your pitch is complete. You must also take care not to abuse the power you now hold. The frame master, which is what you will be when you get good at all this, knows that dominating the frame is not how you win the game, but rather a means to win the game. Nobody likes to be dominated. So once you own the frame, use its power in ways that are fun and mutually exciting. Small acts of denial and defiance are enormously powerful frame disruptors. They equalize the social power structure and then transfer all of the power to you. Then all you need to do is hold on to the power and use it wisely. Let's talk about the prize frame. Another common situation occurs when the key decision maker does not attend the meeting as was agreed to. This situation requires a special kind of response that will not only reaffirm your control of the frame, but will also establish you as someone unlike anyone else they've dealt with before. Let's say that you've done everything right so far. You've come into the business interaction and quickly asserted strong frames and hopefully frame control with the people that you've just met. You're ready to start your pitch and are waiting for Mr. Big to come in. And when his assistant steps in to announce, "Hey, I'm sorry, Mr. Big just called. He can't make the meeting for another hour." He says, "Start without him," and she turns to leave. This is a defining moment for you. You have just lost the frame, and there is nothing you can do about it. However, this does not mean that you have no choices. Your options are: go ahead with your presentation, even though you know you've lost the frame, and you can hope for the best and hope that maybe Mr. Big will join the group towards the end of the meeting. I would not recommend this. The second choice is to stop everything. Reframe using power, time, or prize frames, which are covered in this section, or perhaps all of these. Immediately take the power back. You've traveled to this meeting, you've prepared for it, and you have an established goal. Are you willing to throw all that away? No way. No one can tell your story as well as you can. If you trust your presentation to subordinates and expect them to pass it on to the decision maker, Mr. Big, with the same force and qualities of persuasion that you have, then you are not being honest with yourself. Again, no one can tell your story as well as you can. Mr. Big must hear it, and he must hear it from you. This is what I usually say in this situation. So you guys are asking me to delay the start of the presentation. Okay, I can give you, say, 15 minutes to get yourselves organized, but if we can't start by then let's just call it a day. Usually, someone will volunteer to track down Mr. Big, and that person will try as hard as he or she can to find him and request that he join the meeting. Or someone will say, "Hey, let's go ahead with the presentation and we'll make sure that Mr. Big is briefed." You can't let your frame get absorbed by this. Your response, "No, we're not going to follow your agenda. This meeting is going to start when I say it starts, and it will end when I say stop. You're going to make sure that all the right people are here and they come to the meeting on time. Then we're going to cover the items on my agenda, and you're going to pay attention to every minute of my presentation." You only think this way, of course. What you actually say is, "Hey, I can wait 15 minutes, but then I have to leave." That's enough to get the message through. The first time you think this way and say these words, you'll be uncomfortable. Let me correct that. You'll be terrified and you'll wonder if you're really doing the right thing. Your heart will race and you'll fear the consequences of your boldness, afraid of having offended your audience. You'll second guess yourself and you think you've just made an awful mistake. And then something awesome will happen. The people in the room will scramble, doing their best to prevent you from being offended, doing their best to keep you from leaving. They are now worried about you. When you own the frame, others react to you. Like Peter Parker's transformation into Spider-Man, you will suddenly be empowered by an internal change of state that is felt by everyone in the room. Be judicious with this power, as you are now in complete control of the situation. If you stand, pack up your things and leave, it will be a social disaster for Mr. Big and his staff. So be benevolent. Give Mr. Big the promised 15 minutes to arrive and act politely but true to your frame. And if he does not show at that point, you leave. You do not deliver your presentation. You do not leave brochures and you do not apologize. Your time has been wasted and you don't even need to say it. They know. If it seems appropriate, and if this is a company with which you want to do business, tell the most important person in the room that you're willing to reschedule, but on your turf. That's right. You offer to reschedule and acknowledge that these things happen. Hey, we've all missed meetings before, but for the next meeting, they come to you. This is a subtle framing technique known as prizing. What you do is reframe everything your audience does and says as if they're trying to win you over. A few moments earlier, you learned that Mr. Big wasn't coming to your meeting, and apparently you were just the morning entertainment. Now, however, you're communicating to your buyers that they are here to entertain you. What prizing subconsciously says to your audience is, you're trying to win my attention. I'm the prize, not you. I can find 1,000 buyers, audiences, investors, clients, whatever, like you. There is only one of me. It also conveys to your audience that if they wish to get any further information from you, they'll first have to do something to earn it. Prizing 101, right? To solidify the prize frame, you make the buyer qualify himself to you. You could say something like, hey, can you tell me more about yourself? I'm picky about who I work with. At a primal croc brain level, you've just issued a challenge. Why do I want to do business with you? This is a powerful and unspoken expression of your high status and your frame dominance. It forces your audience to qualify themselves by telling you exactly how interested they really are. So does this sound outrageous? It's not, I promise you. When you rotate the circle of power 180 degrees, it changes everything. The predator becomes the prey. In this instance, what your target is feeling is a kind of moral shame. They've wronged you, and they feel obligated to make things right. Initially, you walked in with low status. Just another pitch and a long string of pitches. Over many experiences, these people have learned how to have their way with salespeople and presenters like you. But now, you've broken their power play. They will apologize, appease, and try to correct for the social gaffe they're making. And in most cases, if Mr. Big is in the building, they'll find a way to get him in front of you. In a moment, I'm going to address what happens when you encounter time frames and analyst frames. Before going into these aspects of framings in greater detail, though, I think it might help to prepare the ground if I recount how I came to develop and use frames over the years. As you will see, the practical side of frames grew out of my personal experiences, sometimes in high-stakes situations where there was much to be gained and lost. Remember, when you own the frame, people respond to you. Let me share an example of this from my own experience. I'll talk to you now about the avocado farmer's money. I had looked down at my phone, 14 missed phone calls, all from the same person, D. Walter. I turned off my ringer for less than 30 minutes, and the phone had just blown up. I listened to one of his messages. Oren, I have a serious problem, it started. Well, his serious problem was a deal that had already gone bad, and now it was my job to help. D. Walter, or Dennis Walter, was an avocado farmer, a guy who got his overalls dirty, a guy who put in long days in the hot sun. After 35 years, he was ready for retirement. He had money saved, but a good portion of it, $640,000, was in an escrow account, controlled by a man named Donald McGann. Dennis wanted his money back, and he wanted it now, and it was his legally, but he was unable to get it back despite repeated attempts. This was now affecting an $18 million deal that both Dennis and I were in. If Dennis couldn't wire his money to me, all $640,000, then the deal, a large property I was buying in Hawaii, would start to unwind. So his problem was now my problem too. To retrieve Dennis's money, I would have to sit down with McGann and make an appeal to get the money back. This is how I was thrust into a pitch that clearly was doomed to fail. It wasn't life and death, but it was close. This was a man's life savings I was going to pitch for. So I knew a little bit about this McGann guy. He had a reputation as a successful businessman, primarily in the field of medical devices. While he was at Dow Corning in the 1960s, he helped invent the first generation of silicone breast implants. Today, he owned two companies, Medicor and Southwest Exchange. Medicor's breast implant business had looked promising for a while, but the success enjoyed there was short-lived, and McGann turned desperate. To keep the breast implant business, Medicor, solvent, McGann began siphoning the money away from the other business, Southwest Exchange. Southwest Exchange, which McGann bought in 2004, gave him instant access to over $100 million of escrow accounts. Real estate investors, like my guy, Dennis, had used Southwest Exchange to hold their money while looking for new investments. Soon after acquiring Southwest Exchange, McGahn, and this is according to federal investigators, transferred $47 million from Southwest to Medicorp. Just like that. And that money included the $640,000 from Dennis, the avocado farmer. Now, I was on our corporate jet, going to Las Vegas, on my way to help Dennis attempt the impossible. I thought about McGahn and what it might be like to confront him face to face. At the time, I had no idea I was walking into a $100 million problem involving hundreds of investors, or that McGahn was a bad guy, a criminal, and he was presiding over a large-scale Ponzi scheme. All I knew was that this was not going to be pleasant. As I drove to Henderson, a Las Vegas suburb, I had a strong sense of purpose. Not only was McGahn harming Dennis, not only was McGahn in the wrong, but the lost $640,000 was holding up my Hawaii deal, and that's how I make money. I pulled into Southwest Exchange parking lot, and I met Dennis for the first time in person. He was a nice guy, farmer, looked like your typical farmer working type, and like a guy who really needed my help. I was nervous, though. Although I almost always enjoy pitching deals, it's usually for new business. Making this kind of pitch to get money back, a lot of money, from a bad deal is mentally and emotionally tough. To calm myself, I thought about frame control and all the other methods that I'd spent countless hours learning and trying to master. And as I mentioned before, no situation has real meaning until you frame it. Frames are mental structures that shape the way you see the world and put relationships in context. The frame you put around a situation completely and totally controls its meaning. But you aren't the only one framing. People are always trying to impose frames on each other. The frame is like a picture of what you want the interaction to be about. And the most powerful thing in frames, there can only be one dominant frame during any interaction between two people. When two frames come together, the strongest frame absorbs the weaker frame. Then weak arguments and rational facts just bounce off the winning frame. Dennis and I spoke for a few minutes in the parking lot. I prepared my frame. Then, just like that, I was ready. So we walked into the building together, and I went looking for the one guy who had caused all these problems, Donald McGahn. It was 9 a.m. when we walked into the building. It was a generic-looking office with a black leather couch and magazines spread neatly on a coffee table. "Good morning. How can I help you?" a receptionist asked. "Well, I don't need help," I said. "Just tell me which office Don McGahn is in." She began her gatekeeper script, right? And you're all familiar with this. "I'll see if he's in." Rituals like these are meant to reinforce status hierarchies. But I was there to establish my own status and frame control, and certainly not to supplicate to a gatekeeper. I strode past the front desk and down the hallway, the gatekeeper chasing behind me. She tried to keep me out of the office, to keep me from finding Dennis's money, so I had no choice but to start throwing open doors to various offices, interrogating everyone and anyone. What were they going to do? Call the cops? Back in my office, my partner already called the local police and the FBI. "Where's Don McGahn?" I announced. Right? And there were plenty of people now trying to stop me, but I wasn't going to stop until I'd spoken to McGahn, and I wasn't going to leave without Dennis's $640,000. I made my way through the building, office by office. Well, during that time, Don McGahn hustled himself out the back door, not wanting to deal with me. Instead, he sent his son Jim, who finally came out to handle things. Jim McGahn, he's in his early 40s, was dressed in an Armani suit. He had a confident, arrogant way about him. He was tall and he looked down at me. We sat in a conference room and right away he was trying to take control, trying to frame things by saying, "There's a rational explanation for all of this." So that was his game. He was playing the analyst frame, right? Which relies on facts, figures, logic, reason, ration. I had a better frame prepared, the moral authority frame. And it's an analyst disruptor. "Jim, you cannot hold Dennis's money," I told him. "We've requested it properly, and you're going to go get it for him right now." Well, Jim was a player. I saw in his eyes, but he knew that his scheme was falling apart, and he wasn't interested in giving Dennis the money. Instead, the money probably would be wired to McGahn's attorney by the day's end, and we'd never get it. He knew what he was doing. He was using status and authority to confidently explain the so-called facts. I give him credit for one thing. Jim pulled off a beautiful analyst frame. He was completely unfazed, arrogant, and acting puzzled as why we were even there. Then he began with a rational, highly detailed, and analytical explanation of why the money couldn't be transferred right away. Well, this was the squaring off phase. He was trying to spin. He thought he could put us off and have us go away empty-handed. Of course, I was not having that. I came in with a moral authority frame that we were right and he was wrong. A nearly unshakable frame that, when used correctly, works definitively. The game was on, and he knew my frame, and I knew his. Next came the moment of first contact. It's that moment when two opposing frames are about to collide with full force. You can feel it, usually as a pang of anxiety in the pit of your stomach. It is at this moment when you need to strengthen your resolve and commit completely to your frame. No matter what happens, no matter how much social pressure and discomfort you suffer, you must stay composed and stick to your frame. This is called plowing. So to prepare yourself to plow, as an ox might plow a field, always moving forward, never stopping, never any self-doubt. And as you're about to see, when two frames collide, the stronger one always wins. The niceties did not last long. I spoke plainly and looked Jim right in the eyes. We want Dennis's $640,000, and we're getting all of it back from you today, right now. He hemmed and hawed, threw out a bunch of promises, half-truths, and what I call MBA double talk. But I saw through the gibberish, and I had the stronger frame, moral authority. And I plowed. "Look," I said, "your lips are moving, but I'm not listening to a single word. Your words have no meaning. Stop talking. Just start transferring money." He blinked. He tried one more time to explain, to argue, to rationalize why the money hadn't been transferred to Dennis. Something about misplaced wire transfer numbers. But rational explanations will never override a moral authority frame. At one point, I saw the realization cross his face. He knew that he had picked the weaker frame. In fact, he tried the moral authority frame out for himself, right? "You know what? I've had enough of this," he said. "Get out of here now. I'm going to call the cops." But it was too late for him. He had already picked a weak analyst frame and had overcommitted to it and was about to pay for doing so. It was time for frame disruption. I was ready to pulverize his frame into a puff of fine mist. I pulled out my phone and dialed a colleague, Sam Greenberg. I put him on speaker and discussed the logistics of getting the FBI involved. Dramatic, sure, yeah. But Jim McCann knew at that moment we were 100% committed to following through. I was activating the primal fears in his croc brain. As soon as he became afraid, my frame would really crush his, and he would bend to my will. "Let me paint a picture for you, Jim," I told him. "You've seen SWAT teams in the movies, right? It happens just like that. They're going to come through this door. FBI accountants wearing Kevlar vests and Glock 22 firearms. And the sheriff will be blasting pepper spray at anything that moves. Dogs will be barking, and they'll be fastening your hands behind your back with zip ties. Is that how you want today to end? Hogtied, pepper sprayed, lying the back of a black van with no windows. The other option is you start transferring money to us." Boom, smash. That was the moral authority frame delivered with emotional realism. And here, I had achieved the hook point. Our frames had collided. My frame had absorbed his. The only options were my options. And there's a moment in games of strategy when the other side realizes that no matter what moves it makes, the game is lost. This was that moment. I now had his full realization. Although it was his office and his domain, I had seized the high status position, and although he still had our money, $640,000, I had frame control. "Jim, starting right now, every 15 minutes, you're going to give me a deliverable. That means, just so you understand me perfectly, every 15 minutes, something happens that benefits me. Cancel your schedule, do not leave this room, pick up the phone, and start finding our money." He was listening, and I continued. "I need the money wired to Dennis's account right now." So, just because you have frame control doesn't mean that someone won't push back. You just stay committed to your frame and you keep it strong. You plow. Jim started with more MBA doublespeak, returning to rationalization mode. I expanded the frame to include new characters, new consequences. "Listen, Jim, stop that," I told him. "Get your friends and your family and your investors and start dialing for money. Every 15 minutes, you need to hand me a wire transfer confirmation that we're getting money." This was the point of consolidation. Because I'd done everything else right up to this point, there was no need to make threats or create drama. The frame was set. The agenda was my agenda. Because the social interaction was being governed by my frame, these were the rules I had Jim follow. Rule one, everything that happens here today in this room must involve Dennis's money. Number two, something good must happen every 15 minutes. And rule number three, this meeting is not over until all $640,000 that were due is wired. Well, I sat with Jim for 6 long hours as he dialed associates, family members, and friends. The money came rolling in small increments, $10,000 here, $15,000 there. As I mentioned earlier, when two mental frames come together, when they collide, the stronger frame disrupts and absorbs the weaker frame. I'd control the frame, started it small, and expanded it, and Jim's weaker frame collapsed. His internal state went from nonchalance and arrogance to panic and desperation. His status went from high to low, and responding to my frame, he raised Dennis's money, and we walked out of there with all $640,000 that had been missing, irrevocably secured by wire transfers. Mission accomplished. Over the next few days, Dennis and I and some other victims worked with authorities, and Southwest Exchange was fully raided. I got Dennis's $640,000 out just in time, thanks to my knowledge of framing. Not for a moment was I about threats or power plays, right? Although it was Dennis's money legally, perhaps Jim and Don McCann should never have given back the $640,000. It wasn't in their best interest. If Jim McCann really thought I was going to call the FBI, he should have wired that money to his attorney. It was clearly the last bit of cash that he could scratch together. I had always respected the nature of frame control, but now, with Dennis's $640,000 back in my escrow account and my deal getting ready to close, I was learning to rely on it more and more often. All told, the McGanns had bilked more than 130 investors out of more than $180 million. Several people lost their life savings, and the case spawned numerous lawsuits. In 2009, Don McGann, age 75 then, was sentenced to 10 years in prison for the wire fraud. This is an example of owning the frame. There are still more frames you'll encounter that I haven't discussed yet. Let's take a look at time-based frames next and how to respond to them. The time frame. Frames involving time tend to occur later in the social exchange after someone has already established frame control. Again, when you want to know who has the frame, it's easy to observe. When you are reacting to the other person, that person owns the frame. When the other person is reacting to what you do and what you say, you own the frame. Time frames are often used by your target to re-challenge your frame by disrupting you and in a moment of confusion, unwittingly take back control. As long as you're alert, time frames are easy to defeat. You will know a time frame collision is about to occur when you see attention beginning to wane. You've been pitching for a few minutes, some period of time, and the temperature in the room is noticeably cooler. The game you initiated was fun at the beginning, and now the audience is cooled and it might be a little bit bored. There are limits to the human attention span, which is why a pitch must be brief, concise, and interesting, and you'll hear about that in Chapter 4. If you wait for someone in the audience to say or give body language to the effect of, "Hey, we only have a few minutes left, so let's start to wrap this up," then you will lose the frame because you now have to react to that person. Instead, when you see attention beginning to bottom out and expire, well, recognize that's it, you're done. Stay in control of time and start wrapping up. Running long or beyond the point of attention shows weakness, neediness, and desperation. In Chapter 4, I'll explore attention extensively, and you'll begin to understand that attention is an extremely rare cognitive phenomena, and it's difficult to create and it's difficult to manage. When attention is lacking, then set your own time constraint and bounce out of there. You could say this, "Hey, looks like time's up. I've got to wrap this up and get to my next meeting." If they're interested in you, they will agree to a follow-up. Ironically, the mistake most people make when they see their audience becoming fatigued is to talk faster to try and force their way through the rest of the pitch. Instead of imparting more valuable information faster, they only succeed in helping the audience retain less of the message. So here's an example of an opposing time frame and how you can respond to it. If you visit customers' offices, you will recognize this situation, right? The customer says, "Oh yeah, hey, look, we only have about 10 minutes to meet with you, but come on in." And then the salesperson will say, "Hey, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for fitting me into your busy schedule." This is a common dialogue and a form of business etiquette, and it is exactly the wrong thing to do. When you do this kind of thing, you're reinforcing your target's power over you and confirming your target's high status. You are essentially handing your target your frame and saying, "Here, please crush me, control me, waste my time." When you encounter a time frame like this, quickly break it with a stronger prize frame of your own. Qualify your target on the spot. Say something like this, "10 minutes? No, I don't work like that. And maybe we could reschedule, but There's no sense in rescheduling unless we like each other and trust each other. And so I need to know, you know, are you good to work with? Can you keep time and appointments? And can you stick to a schedule? And they'll say, hey, you know what? You're right about that. Yeah, we sure can stick to a schedule and keep our appointments. Why don't we do this now? I'll make it 30 minutes. And if that's no problem, why don't you come on in? Doing it this way, you have broken your target's time frame, established that your time is important. And now they have to be giving you focused attention instead of treating you and your visit like an annoyance. Another frame you'll encounter is called the analyst frame. Like the time frame, the analyst frame usually appears after the initial frame collision and can derail you just when you're about to reach a decision in the deal. It's a deadly frame, and you must know about how to repel it and how to use the intrigue frame in response. So let's talk about the intrigue frame. How many times have you been giving a presentation when suddenly one or more people in the room take a deep dive into technical details? That's the analyst frame coming at you. This is especially common in industries that involve engineers, financial analysts, and this frame will kill your pitch. The moment your audience does a deep drill down into the minute details of what you have, you're losing control. The cognitive temperature of the audience, which was hot when things got started, naturally will cool as the audience members listen to your pitch. But once you give their neocortexes something to calculate, they will go cold. Problem solving, numerical calculations, statistics, and any sort of geometry are called cold cognitions. Nothing will freeze your pitch faster than allowing your audience to grind on numbers or study details during the pitch. As you'll learn in chapter 4, the key to preventing this is to control access to details. Sometimes, however, a drill down will happen anyway, and you'll have to act fast. It is important to realize human beings are unable to have hot cognition and cold cognition simultaneously. The brain is not wired that way. Hot cognitions are feelings like wanting or desire or excitement. And cold cognitions come from cold processes like analysis and problem solving. To maintain frame control and momentum, you must force your audience to be analytical on their own time. You do this by separating the technical and the detailed material from your presentation. Oh, look, for sure, right? Audience members will ask for details. They believe that they need them. So what should you do if someone demands details? You respond with summary data that you have prepared for this specific purpose. You answer the question directly and with the highest level of information possible, then you redirect their attention back to your pitch. In financial deals, I respond something like this. Look, the revenue is $80 million, expenses are $62 million, and the net income is $18 million. These and the other facts you can verify later. But right now, what we need to focus on is, are we a good fit? Should we be doing business together? Where do our circles overlap? Does this make sense to do from both sides? This is what I came here to work on. If you're pitching a product and the drill down is on price, don't chase this conversation thread. Do answer fast, answer directly with high-level details, and go straight back to the relationship question. What this tells the audience is that, one, I'm trying to decide if the kind of buyer you are is right for me as the seller. Number two, if I decide to work with you, right, the numbers will back up everything I'm telling you. Let's not worry about that right now. And three, I care about who I work with. Keep the target focused on the business relationship. Analysis comes later. This is the best and most reliable way to deal with a target who suddenly becomes bored and tries to entertain himself with the details of your deal. Remember, when you own the frame, you control the agenda and you determine the rules under which the game is played. There will be times when you're doing everything right, but for reasons beyond your understanding or beyond your control, the other person stops responding to you. The personal connection you had at one point seems to be fading. When it no longer seems that communication is flowing back and forth naturally, and the other person is in something called a non-reactive state, it's like the other person's mind is wandering or thinking about something else. This is a state of disinterest, and you can correct for it if you recognize it in time and act quickly. You can tell this is starting to happen when you notice remarks or body language indicate that your presentation is not intriguing. When the target thinks he can easily predict what your idea is before you even explain it, or when he feels he can anticipate what you're going to say and how you're going to say it. Most intelligent people take great pleasure in being confronted with something new, novel, and intriguing. Being able to figure out what things are is a form of entertainment for us as humans. It's like solving the Sunday puzzle. Our brains are wired to look for these kinds of pleasurable challenges. When you describe your idea initially to your target, you were pulling on a primal lever. When the target agreed to take the meeting with you, what he was really saying was, "This is a puzzle I'm interested in seeing, learning about, and solving." No one takes a meeting to hear about something they already know and understand. It's a fundamental concept driving every single presentation. It's the hook that allows you as a presenter to grab and hold attention by subconsciously saying, "I have a solution to one of your problems, and I know something that you don't." This is why people agree to take meetings and to hear a pitch. At the start of the meeting, you have the audience's attention. It's a rare moment, but not for the reason you may think. Audience members are, with full concentration and at the most basic and primal level, trying to figure out the answer to this question. How similar is your idea to something I already know about or to a problem I have already solved? If audience members discover that the answer is close to what they had earlier guessed, they will mentally check out on you. They will experience a quick ping of self-satisfaction at the moment of realization that they can guess and know what you're talking about, just before they mentally check out. But checking out is not just a catchphrase, right, to describe drifting attention or wandering minds. Checking out in this context refers to something very specific. It's an extreme and nearly total loss of alertness. And this is exactly what you need to avoid. As your pitch moves along, at any time, some or all members of your audience will solve the puzzle, see the solution, and get the whole story. Then they check out. This is why you see presenters lose more and more of the audience as time goes on. Those who solve the puzzle drop out. We generalize by saying, "Oh, they lost interest." But what really happened is they learned enough about our idea to feel secure that they understand it. And there's nothing more to be gained by continuing to pay attention. They determined that there was no more value to be had by engaging with us on any level. As I've said before, the brain is a cognitive miser. Unless it can get value for itself, it stops paying attention. The analyst frame can devastate your pitch because it only values hard data and ignores the value of relationships and ideas. This frame is completely lacking in any kind of emotion or connection to the people in the room. The most effective way to overcome the analyst frame is an intrigue frame. Of the four frame types at your disposal, intrigue is the most powerful because it hijacks the higher cognitive function to arouse the more primitive systems of the target's brain. Narrative and analytical information does not coexist. They cannot. It's simply impossible. The human brain is unable to be coldly analytical and warmly engaged in a narrative at the same time. This is really the secret power of the intrigue frame. When your target drills down into technical material, you break that frame by telling a brief but relevant story that involves you. This is not a story that you make up on the spot. This is a personal story that you've prepared in advance and that you take to every meeting you have. Since all croc brains are pretty similar, you will not need more than one story because the intrigue it will contain will have the same impact on every audience. You need to be at the center of the story, which immediately redirects attention back to you. People will pause, look up, and listen because you're sharing something personal. As you share your story, there has to be some suspense to it because you're going to create intrigue in the telling of the story by telling only part of the story. That's right. You break the analyst frame by capturing audience attention with a provocative story of something that happened to you, and then you keep their attention by not telling them how it ends until you are ready to do that. This is much more powerful than you may imagine. Now, I can't give you a story to tell. That has to come from you. But what I can do is tell you what your story should contain and then tell you my personal analyst frame crusher so you can see how the elements come together to recapture and hold audience attention. The intrigue story, right? Your intrigue story needs the following elements. One, it must be brief and the subject must be relevant to your pitch. 2. You need to be at the center of the story. 3. There should be risk, danger, and uncertainty. 4. There should be time pressure. A clock is ticking somewhere, and there are ominous consequences if action is not taken quickly. 5. There should be tension. You are trying to do something, but are being blocked by some force. 6. There should be serious consequences. Failure will not be pretty. What's new here is not that you should tell some kind of story to your target. What's new and important is when to use it. And as soon as you recognize that the target is coming at you with an analyst frame, then use it to nudge him out of analytical thinking. There are half a dozen ways to disrupt the analyst frame. Anger and extreme surprise are two. But in most social situations, they're impractical. The intrigue frame does it better, and it does it fast. Here's my intrigue story, which I will tell you first, and then I will show you how I tell this story to my audience. This is called the Porterville Incident. Recently, I was traveling in our company plane with my business partner and our attorney. We were at an airstrip in Porterville, a small California town about 300 miles from San Francisco. While this tiny airstrip served mostly small local aircraft, jet traffic in the air was heavy because of the many commercial planes going in and out of San Francisco. A jet must make a rapid and steep ascent after takeoff to join in with the busy traffic pattern. In a pitch setting, I do not tell this story the way I just relate it to you. When I was meeting with the officials from a local airport, I told this story much differently, knowing that my audience was made up of aviators, engineers, and guys interested in jets. I came to the meeting with this story prepared and ready to deploy if needed. As it happened, I did encounter an attack from an opposing analyst frame, and this story easily brought the meeting back under my control. As the audience's attention began to shift to analytical questions, this is what I said. You know, this reminds me of the Porterville incident. A while ago, my partner and I flew to Porterville to look at two deals. You guys know they have a tiny airfield. It's visual flight rules only and has no control tower. Mostly, they get single-engine traffic, Cessna Skycatchers, and Beechcraft Bonanzas, maybe a few small jets here and there. So when we got there, our big Legacy 600 skidded to a stop at the far edge of the runway. But the landing was nothing compared to the takeoff. Since Porterville airspace is under San Francisco air traffic control, 260 miles away, the trick to getting out of there is to climb fast and merge quickly into the traffic pattern. We expected an aggressive takeoff, and it was no big deal when we found ourselves accelerating hard into a steep climb. The Legacy 600 is a muscle car of a jet. When it's under full power, you feel it. So we're heavy and deep in this full power ascent. We're having casual business conversation, and I would estimate that our altitude was 9,000 feet when abruptly the jet surges and then nosedives. We dropped 1,000 feet in a few seconds. My seat is facing forward towards the cockpit. The door is open and I can see the pilots. We're all clinging to our seats and cursing. A klaxon is howling and one of the pilots is saying, "It's TCAS, it's the TCAS." But I didn't even know at the time what a traffic collision avoidance system was. I'm trying to figure this all out and I'm thinking, this is it, I'm done. As we're plummeting in this nosedive, I look through the door into the cockpit and I see both pilots with their hands on the throttle. Then the plane rolls into a steep climb and I see the pilots fighting, literally slapping each other's hands off the throttle. The climb is short, just 5 seconds. And then the plane goes into a nosedive again. Anyway, and then I just go right back into my pitch. Why does this strategy work so well? The most extreme explanation is that the audience becomes immersed in the narrative. They take the emotional ride with me. Sure, they know that we obviously survived, but I've piqued their curiosity. Why were the pilots fighting? They want to know. When I do not tell them, the intrigue spikes high enough to shock them out of their analyst frame. In my experience with this approach, the opposing analyst frame gets crushed by emotional, engaging, and relevant narratives like this. Attention redirects back to me, allowing me to finish my pitch on my agenda, my timeline, my topics. After I finish the pitch, I complete the narrative arc by explaining the whole story. Well, it turns out that the sudden dive was caused by the traffic collision avoidance software built into the autopilot system. It had detected another airplane flying into our ascent path, and then the computer had taken evasive measures just in time to avoid a crash. This was a very close call, and I'm fortunate to be able to share this story with you right now. The reason the pilots were fighting over the controls was because the co-pilot did not know the computer had taken over. But the pilot, older and more experienced, knew this and was pulling the co-pilot's hands off the controls. The collision avoidance software was doing its job correctly. This true story has everything I need in an intrigue story. It's brief. It has a tight timeline. It has danger, suspense, and intrigue. What were those pilots doing? And as it happened to be perfectly relevant to a pitch I was making to the operators of an airport, which you will read about later. Perhaps in a broader sense, this is why we tell each other intriguing narratives, right? To participate in powerful emotional experiences involving high-stakes situations that we hope we will never have to face ourselves. A short, personal narrative like this is important to your audience because it reveals something about you, your character, and your life. As you think about your own intrigue story, don't be afraid to make it very personal. As long as it's relevant to your business and has the six elements described earlier, it will serve you well. How to stop the analyst frame cold. The key to using the intrigue frame is to trust in its power to stop the analyst frame, as I said, cold. Remember, the person using the analyst frame will break your pitch into pieces and ultimately crush it if it's unchecked. The analyst frame filters your deal like this. 1. It focuses on hard facts only. 2. It says that the aesthetic or creative features that you have no value. 3. It requires that everything must be supported by a number or a statistic. And 4. It holds that ideas and human relationships have no value. Do not let your audience go there. Keep audience members focused on the relationship they are building with you. Your intrigue story breaks this analyst rule set in an entertaining way, and it replaces analytical thinking with narrative discourse. Let's talk about how to break the analyst frame with suspense. Consider the movie Jaws for a moment. This 1975 Steven Spielberg film is a classic, and decades later, it's still doing a great business on DVD. Why does this story work so well? In the first part of the film, Spielberg does not show you the shark. The great white lurks below the surface, creating a sense of terror and suspense. Where is it? When will it strike next? How big is it? We see someone in the water minding her own business. Then we see her as a victim, screaming, kicking, getting pulled under, and eventually disappearing in a froth of red water. This predator is unseen, and we have no idea where it's going to strike next. This creates great tension, and we're riveted to the action. Now, let's reimagine Jaws. Let's assume that the shark is fitted with a GPS transponder and that we know its exact location at all times. We know where the shark is going, where it's been, and what it looks like. When it comes time to hunt the shark, Police Chief Martin Brody and the crazy shark hunter Quint know exactly where to go and what they're up against. Strapping a GPS transponder to the shark strips away the mystery and the intrigue. Telling the story this way would have wiped out nearly $1 billion in box office revenue. If you know where the shark is at all times, you have no tension, no suspense, no blockbuster. The same can be said for your narrative. Use the elements of surprise and tension. And as you approach the most interesting part of the story, move away from it and leave the audience intrigued until you are ready to reveal. Clearly, this technique made Spielberg one of the most successful directors in history. It works for me in business settings, and it will also work for you. Let's talk about the prizing frame, okay? The prizing frame reloaded. Prizing is a way to deal with threatening and fast-approaching frames that are likely to push you into a low-status position. When you prize, you frame yourself as high value in the eyes of your target. Prize correctly, and your target will be chasing you. Establishing a prize frame is the very first thing you need to do when you are on someone else's turf, ready to begin your pitch. When you get to the end of your pitch and it's time to get a deal, your success depends on how well you establish your frames at the beginning and how strong those frames actually are. For a moment, think of the alternative to having strong frames. One is to sell harder by making more calls and being more pushy. In fact, our business culture has a fascination with the idea that a salesperson should never take no for an answer. There's pressure from the top, right? Always be chasing, always be closing. Everyone has heard a friend tell a version of this story. The buyer didn't want my product, but I wouldn't take no for an answer. I just kept pounding away until he finally signed up. These kind of stories dramatize the myth that you can succeed by badgering your clients into buying something. The truth is, this rarely works. And when it does, you are sure to encounter buyer's remorse. The same is true with pitching. If you think you can browbeat your target until he finally relents, you have it backwards. Whenever we chase someone or value someone else more than ourselves, we assume the subordinate position and put ourselves at a serious disadvantage. Although we talked briefly about this before, I'll now introduce you in much greater depth to the concept of prizing and the prize frame. Who is the prize, or who is chasing whom, is one of the underlying social dynamics that influences most meetings. The answer establishes a person's motivation and tells us how they will probably behave in the meeting. Here's the basics. If you are trying to win your target's respect, attention, and money, he becomes the prize. When your target is trying to win your attention and respect, then you are the prize. And this is, of course, what you want. Prizing is the sum of the actions you take to get your target to understand that he is a commodity and that you are the prize. Successful prizing results in your target chasing you, asking to be involved in your deal. So why is prizing so important? Successful prizing restores calm and poise to the social interaction. You won't have to chase as hard or worry so much about impressing your target. But there's another important benefit. It reduces your feeling of needing to perform to get a reward. Consider the way people talk about a presentation. They often call it a dog and pony show. This label evokes self-defeating imagery of you riding around in a circle on a pony. The only thing missing is what? Rainbow suspenders and a clown nose. Getting rid of those negative labels and ideas is an important step. When you are no longer performing for the money, the frame changes drastically. Sure, it's easy to think that you have to earn the buyer or the investor's approval to win the money, especially when you're in the investor's office on his turf giving your pitch. The prize frame is the window through which you look at the world that allows you to see yourself as the prize. The money has to earn you, not the other way around. You are flipping the script. Why does prizing work? Your pitch is first going to register in the target's croc brain. And as we discussed in chapter one, the croc brain would like to ignore you. But if you're dynamic enough, giving new and novel information, you will capture the croc's attention. Once that happens, the croc is going to have one of two primal reactions: curiosity and desire, or fear and dislike. Breaking it down into such simple terms helped me understand a crucial concept. If you trigger curiosity and desire, the croc sees you as something it wants to chase. You become the prize. Let's consider three of the most fundamental behaviors of human beings. One, we chase that which moves away from us. Two, we want what we cannot have. And three, we only place value on things that are difficult to obtain. Are these universally valid laws that can be relied on in all social interactions? I think they are. And by now, you can see where I'm going with this. If you pitch in front of strangers, you know how easy it is to come across as a little too eager to do business. At the same time, you might make it seem too easy to get what you have. All your audience has to do is nod, and you will do everything else. It's just too obvious that you're willing to do anything at all to make them happy. The problem with this approach is that if it is true that people only value things that are hard to get, you are not hard to get. There's no challenge. Behaving this way means that you are failing to prize. And if you're pitching for money, your problems can multiply. Framing money as the prize is a common error, and often a fatal one. Money is never a prize. It is a commodity, a means for getting things done. Money simply transfers economic value from place to place, so people are able to work together. Let's talk about pricing 201, more advanced, avoiding the big mistakes. The prize frame works only if certain conditions are fulfilled. In pricing 101, you learn two basic ideas. One, make the buyer qualify himself back to you. Do this by asking such questions as, why would I want to do business with you? And number two, protect your status. Don't let the buyer change the agenda, the meeting time, or who will attend. Withdraw if the buyer wants to force this kind of change. Pricing 201 offers additional lessons beyond the previous learning. One, there is a great temptation to use trial closes because we've all been told this is how selling should be done, right? So, are we in the ballpark? Or, hey, what do you think so far? Right? Don't do this. This shows you as being a little too eager to get a deal done. Anyway, trial closes are crude and really ineffective. Number two, instead, take the time to step back, to withdraw. Work to control the underlying prize frame. And then you don't have to push your ideas so hard. Instead of a trial close, you might issue a challenge, right? Do it with humor or it will feel forced. Like this. So many buyers, yet only one of me. How are you going to compete for my attention? I left out the question mark there for a reason. Because you are not seeking validation from the target. You don't have to ask it as a question. Just issue it as a statement. It's important to get used to making statements instead of asking questions. Doing it this way shows that you aren't constantly seeking validation. Number three, make the target perform a legitimate task to earn the deal. For example, BMW has a special edition M3 that requires you to sign a contract promising to keep it clean and to take care of the special paint. The company won't even let you buy one until you promise this in writing. Number four, what follows might sound like advice from the positive mental attitude crowd, but it's an important part of learning. The prize frame works best when you change your attitude about money, fully realizing that money is almost useless to any buyer or investor until it purchases what you have. Yeah, sure, the investor's money can earn a few bucks in treasury bills or corporate bonds, but that's not what money wants to do. It wants to go to work by investing in deals and buying products. How does this work in the real world? This can seem a little abstract until you fully internalize the following fact. Money cannot do anything without you. The money needs you. When you combine the elements in pricing 101 and 201, at first it feels like you're walking up the down escalator. This is a natural reaction, and don't worry. Pricing does not mean that we have given up the pursuit of buyers entirely. That would be totally absurd. It means we must give up the concept of ABC, or always be closing, a phrase popularized by the sales gurus of the 80s. Instead, you have to embrace the idea that money is a commodity, that it is available in 1,000 places, and that it's all the same no matter where it comes from. Knowing this, it's more likely that you will embrace ABL, always be leaving. And it's also likely that you'll embrace the money that comes with it. Money is a commodity. Every investment banker and economist you'll meet will confirm this. Imagine that. Investors reframed as a commodity, a vending machine for money. When you think about it, this makes perfect sense because there are many places to source money and there's only one of you. Your deal is unique among all others. If you think of yourself and your deal in this way and build the frames around this idea, you'll be pleased at how it will change the social dynamics in your meetings with investors and buyers. If you want to get started with this in a simple, low-risk way, here's a phrase I often use to set the prize frame firmly in place. I'm glad I could find some time to meet with you today, and I do have another meeting right after this. Let's get started. This is a good start because it tells the audience that there are many like them, but only one of you. As you move into your pitch, find moments to reinforce the other frames that you hold. For example, make appropriate comments about the value of your time to strengthen both your time frame and your prize frame. If someone asks a question that is relevant yet veers towards an analytical tangent, let the question just bounce off of your stronger power frame. Save the discussion of details for later after you have said what you want to say. Remember, small acts of defiance and denial combined with humor, are extremely powerful in maintaining your frame control and in reinforcing your high status. Humor is important here, right? Don't leave it out, or I guarantee that you will encounter unpredictable responses. Chapter 3, Status. Status plays an important role in frame control. How others view you is critical to your ability to establish the dominant frame and hold on to the power you take when you win the frame collision. But most people in business and social interactions view status incorrectly. You don't earn status by being polite, by obeying the established power rituals of business, or by engaging in friendly small talk before a meeting starts. What those behaviors might earn you is a reputation for being nice. They do nothing for your social position except reduce it. Another common mistake is underestimating the value of status. People confuse status with charisma or ego, which are entirely different things. And they mistakenly believe that working to raise one's social value is foolish or just an act of peacocking. Nothing could be further from the truth. Unless you're a celebrity, a tycoon, or the guy who just landed your company the largest deal it has ever done, in most cases, you enter a new business setting with a low social position. The harder you try to fit into the social scene, the lower your perceived social value becomes. Yet fitting in and having high social status are essential. Every interaction is affected by a pecking order. Who is the dominant group member and who are the subordinates? And the moment you enter a room to make a pitch, it's a beautiful example of how the social animal inside you works. In those first moments, the alpha and the beta social positions are up for grabs. But it's not a physical skirmish. It's the rapid and sometimes instant assessment of each other's social position. When it comes down to finding the alpha, nobody takes the time to draft a balance sheet of who owns the most assets, who commands the most wealth, and who is the most popular. It's a subconscious and instant recognition of status. Within seconds, we each need to decide, for the sake of our own self-preservation, who in this room is the dominant alpha. And if it turns out that someone else is a dominant alpha and we're the beta, there is a second and even more valuable question. In the short amount of time we have to orient ourselves in this social interaction, can we switch out of the beta position and take the alpha? People will judge your social status almost immediately, and changing their perception is not easy. But it's important because your social status is the platform from which you must pitch. If you're pitching from a lower level platform or low social status, your ability to persuade others will be diminished, and your pitch will be difficult, no matter how great your idea or your product. However, if you hold high social status, even on a temporary basis, your power to convince others will be strong and your pitch will go easily. What I am saying and what I have proven to myself and to others is that you can alter the way people think about you by creating situational status. Let's look at how situational status plays out in a familiar social structure, one we have all encountered at one time or another. I want to talk to you about the French waiter. French waiters are respected throughout the world for their skill in controlling social dynamics. From the moment you enter their world, they set the frame and control the timing and sequence of events according to their wishes. They wipe out your status instantly, redistribute it as they choose, and control the frame throughout the exchange. You regain control only after the check is paid, the tip has been left, and you're ushered out the front door. I watched waiters work their frame magic a few years ago on a bustling boulevard in Paris. I stopped in at restaurant Lip on the main boulevard, and my waiter was Benoit, who started there bussing tables and washing dishes and moved his way up to head waiter. His father worked at this famous Left Bank restaurant before and after World War II, and today, there is nothing about the history of this place that Benoit does not know. Benoit can show you the table where Ernest Hemingway did much of his writing during the 1920s, and can seat you there if he is feeling generous and senses that you will be generous in return. There is nothing he cannot tell you about the menu, every dish, every ingredient, every method of preparation. But to ask questions about the menu is a mild insult. Instead, it's better to ask him to recommend something. The same goes for the wine list, which is even longer than the menu. This is his job. He is the expert within the walls of his restaurant. I entered Lip with some friends I'd invited out to dinner. I was the host, so I carried myself with authority and high status. After all, I was the paying customer about to drop a big chunk of cash, and I wanted the waitstaff to understand my status and give me the best.